Hello. Thank you for listening to and watching You Had Options. This week I have musician, singer, historyman, Frank Turner on. Great conversation. He's got a new single out called Haven't Been Doing So Well. He's got a new album coming out soonish called FTHC, Frank Turner Hardcore. Go follow him on Instagram, social media, all that shit. It's at Frank Turner. Go follow You at Options, at You at Options. There's merch at thehandsomescoundrels.com/shop. Go check that out. Like, comment, subscribe, all that shit. But yeah, great conversation. Enjoy talking to him. Enjoy this episode. Thank you. Hey, Frank.
Hi.
Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. You're taking some time out of your now tour schedule.
Nice to be on a tour. I mean, good Lord. Also, I mean, I have to say, like, so we're being the opening act right now, and it's been a while since I did a support slot on a tour, and it's extremely pleasant in the sense that, like, you know, you just kind of rock up and hang out all day, and then you play for an hour, and then you're done by, like, 8:30, and you don't have to panic about ticket sales, and it's just kind of nice, and there's something quite satisfying about going out in front of a crowd of people who don't know who you are, and you've got an hour to kind of turn them around.
Yeah.
And hopefully, if I do my job right, by the end of it, they're paying attention. So yeah, it's fun. Plus, of course, we're out with Counting Crows, who are one of my all-time favorite bands. So it is an honor to be on the tour.
Yeah. How have you played with them before, or had you hooked up with them before?
I've known Adam for a few years, I mean, I'm a huge fan of their work,
right.
And he surprises me by apparently being a genuine fan of my work. I mean, you know, when one musician meets another, you tend to say nice things because it's just polite,
mm-hmm.
But, like, he actually, like, owns t-shirts with my name written on that I didn't give him,
yeah.
And stuff like this. And we were supposed to do a big tour together last summer,
mm-hmm.
Which didn't happen for obvious reasons. They were decent enough to offer me kind of the reschedule, so here we are.
That's sick. So you're not with the full band right now, it's just you and...
No, it's me and Matt, who is playing mandolin on this run. It's a kind of duo format that we've been doing for a little while. It's a lot of fun. It's cool. It's more than twice as good as solo. Let's say that.
There you go.
But yeah, no, it's a good time, and it's, I mean, it's partly because I think that me doing my sort of full-throated punk rock thing that I do might frighten the horses a little bit at Counting Crows shows, but it's also more, I would say, because getting the finances and the logistics of getting into the United States right now,
yeah.
Are pretty nightmarish, so we've done what we can.
How is that experience coming in to the States?
The actual experience of coming in was fine. It was the process of getting my visas and my permission to fly into the country sorted that was kind of a nightmare. I mean, initially we were just told that we couldn't, and the tour was already booked by this point, and it was like, oh. It turns out there's a way around it, which is essentially, not to put too fine a point in it, to bribe the US government by paying them quite a lot of money, and then suddenly coronavirus doesn't matter, which I sort of have some ethical issues with, but at the same time I need to work, do you know what I mean?
Right.
So here we are. But it's, I mean, I'll say this, I mean, this is going to make me sound terribly highfalutin, but like, it was quite pleasant being on an almost empty flight and going through an almost empty airport, and that was a pleasant change from my previous experiences of spending my life in crowded planes and airports, so that was all right, and landing and checking in was all fine, so, and it's really nice to be back. Like, I usually, in a normal year, we'll spend like 4 or 5 months a year in the United States,
yeah.
On the road, and I love it, like, pretty unconditionally, and I have really, really, really missed it this last 18 months.
Yeah. I noticed you have a new album coming out, Frank Turner Yes. Hardcore.
Yes.
Which is, I love it. I love the,
thank
I love,
you.
Yeah, I love your, I guess you posted a picture of your backdrop, the FTHC.
Yeah, the new design. Yeah. That was fun. We did a kind of like artwork competition type thing.
Yeah.
I mean, just to jump on the grenade before anybody gets irritated about it, like we are paying the designer who won properly, and in fact another guy to do the layouts and everything. Like there are some people who do the artwork competition thing as a way of getting out of paying.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's not what we're doing. It's important to stress that. But we had 600 submissions for it, and you know, some of them were just, I suspect, kind of young kids just kind of sending in their kind of plastic glued to a piece of paper homework type thing. and, you know, some people were just kind of messing around, having fun with it. But there was just an absolute mountain of really, really, really good designs. And in a way, my one regret about doing it is that I had to sort of essentially be pretty brutal in culling through really quite excellent entries from people.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it was just, that doesn't sit too well with me, just kind of going, no, to all these like great designs that people have put some time into. But the guy, Rob Parry, who won, is a lovely guy and a fantastic designer. And that shot that I put up from Punk Rock Bowling was the first time we've kind of, one of the things I like about the new designs is it looks good small and looks good big. And that was the first time I'd seen it big. And and, you know, kind of walked on stage and was like, hell yeah.
Yeah. Did you already have the name Frank Turner Hardcore as the album?
Yeah, I mean, I've been using this FDHC logo thing for years, and it's a funny thing because, like, in the United States, people know what it is. They are, you know, the cross, like, MYHC whatever. People in the UK seem to not know what it is. I mean, hardcore is a more obscure type of music in the UK.
Really?
It's definitely... like when I was growing up and I'd tell people I was into hardcore, they would think I meant happy hardcore, like, you know, that sort of bleepy subdivision of dance music, which I personally don't care for. And of course when I was 16 that filled me with rage.
Right.
No. Black Flag, Minor Threat. Yeah. But so, and on the very first release I did in 2006, I put that logo on the back. It's quite difficult to have a logo as a solo artist, do you know what I mean? So I just kind of did it as a joke, and it's kind of, and it stayed on every release I've done since. And I should add that the old one will be on the new record as well. It's not, we're not like retiring the old logo or whatever, but it just kind of, the new record is very much a more sonically aggressive thing. We've put out two songs from it so far, both of which are kind of in the middle of the aggression spectrum as far as the record goes. So there is definitely some stuff on it that's more chill than those songs, but there's quite a lot of stuff that's considerably less chill than them as well. And I think it's going to surprise some people, and I'm quite excited about that because you know, I kind of entirely deliberately and by choice, but the last two records I did was kind of like, one of them was more of a kind of investigation of like electronic instruments and pop music and stuff, and one of them was a kind of a history folk record, and I think a certain kind of casual observer is kind of on the opinion that I've like gone off the boil or some shit, and I think those people are going to be corrected in their opinion when they hear the new stuff.
The latest single hadn't been doing so well. It reminds me of, like, you know, White Reaper.
It's funny you should say that.
Yeah.
And that was definitely in the mix. So good spot.
Yeah. I guess single guitar notes. I don't know. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I guess growing up, you said people in the UK England didn't really know what hardcore was. So how did you get into like hardcore music?
Well, I mean, it's kind of funny, like, you know, I'm of an age that I was kind of just about old enough to know who Nirvana were just before Kurt Cobain died. And then the next sort of great cultural event in alternative music was Dookie and Smash. And, you know, and that was huge in the UK, like it was over in the States as well.
Yeah.
But then, and I'm sure a similar thing happened in the States as well. There was a sort of filtration system went on. For every 10 kids that got into Dookie and Smash, maybe like five of them might find out who NoFX were. And of those five, maybe two would bother to find out who Descendants were. and maybe one of those would get to Black Flag. And like, it's important to say that I'm not sort of like trying to claim some kind of moral superiority for having bothered to kind of do the mining, but just, you know, it hit me at an age when I was kind of the music spoke to me, punk rock spoke to me very profoundly, and you know, and I was interested in where it came from, because you know, I think one of the things was that like all of those bands from that particular round of punk rock in the 90s were not on their first record. Do you know what I mean? Dookie is not Green Day's first record, and Smash is not Offspring's first record. And it was kind of like, well, what is Epitaph Records? What is this thing that has just kind of like surfaced around here, but has clearly been under the water for a while? And, you know, it was a combination of passion for the music and then I think quite a stereotypically kind of male teenage sort of obsessive personality type thing. Got me into it, and you know, and I really started mining, and then it wasn't long before I had tapes with like Dead Kennedys and Minor Threat and Black Flag and that kind of thing, and then and this being kind of, I mean, not completely pre the internet, but certainly before the internet was anything like what it is now. You know, I got into mail order ordering, so I had like the No Idea Records catalog from Florida, and I had the Initial Records catalog out of Louisville, Kentucky, and you know, various things like that. And I would start like, and you know, you remember distros? I mean, that was a thing. And you know, tape trading, VHS trading, I got really into as well. And then after a time, I discovered that there was a UK hardcore scene. I mean, the UK hardcore scene in the 90s probably consisted nationwide of about 500 people. And, it, you know, it was very, very small fry. But it was so exciting to me to discover that not only were there other people who liked this kind of music, but that they were putting on shows and they were in bands and I could go to those shows. And the only kind of price of entry was interest. Do you know what I mean? It was like, so I remember going to my first, actually, funnily enough, the guy, the, so there was a UK hardcore label called Household Name Records in the 90s, and the guy who ran it was called Lil. And I actually saw Lil just the other day, we're still friends, but he tells a story which I don't fully remember, but he rejoices in telling the story that I went to, my first hardcore show I went to was Agnostic Front at the Garage in London, and he was running the distro that night, and according to him, I went up to the merch table and said, I've got £10 and I want to buy some hardcore. And I was like 15 years old. And he sold, at the time, Household Name had just put out a compilation called UKHC that had like 25 tracks on it by UK hardcore bands. And I picked it up and it was just like, it was like I discovered this kind of secret world, you know what I mean? It was like, holy shit, these bands exist. And I started going to as many shows as I could at that age. And just immersing myself in the scene, and you know, and then I joined a band, formed a band called Knee Jerk, and we played a handful of shows. And I did a zine. If anybody ever discovers a copy of it, I will have them assassinated by ninjas, because it was literally the worst shit you could possibly imagine. I put on a show. I put on one show because basically, and it was mad. We put on a band called Sum Factor, who were a UK like emo core band, and we played Knee Jerk. We played and set up the whole thing, and it was like a 100-cap venue, and it was full. But the guy who I'd been talking to on the phone about the whole thing didn't know when I was doing this that I was 16, which meant that legally I wasn't allowed in the venue. When we showed up for the show, he was like, what the fuck? And he let me play and like do the show, and then he was like, you're never fucking doing this here again. Or at least not for another 2 years. So that was the end of my promotional career. But yeah, you know, it was an exciting time. You know, the whole DIY ethos was so engaging and so liberating and all that kind of thing.
You piqued my interest with the zine. Is there any, can you just remember a little bit of it? Just a small, just a segment? Well,
there was only one issue of said zine. I was super into zine culture, and there was a lot of great zines doing the rounds at the time. There was a brilliant UK zine called Fracture that I used to read, and then, you know, we'd get like Maximum Rock and Roll, like on import and stuff like that, and Comet Bus and whatever else. And my zine was called Paper Cuts, and it was basically It was basically like 40 pages of kind of random emo ramblings.
Okay.
But there was an interview with Guy Picciotto in there.
Oh, shit.
Because I found, this is, it was very early doors for email even being a thing, but yeah. I found an email address for Fugazi and just sent 10 questions.
Yeah.
And he wrote back and answered them all. And I was like, what the fuck? So there was an interview with Guy Picciotto in there, but most of the rest of it was just sort of me pontificating about the world in a
16-year-old.
Quite, yeah, in a like toe-curlingly awful 16-year-old right. kind of way, and talking about straight edge and veganism and all this kind of thing.
Yeah,
that was
you.
Very very au courant at yeah. the time. And you know, it's but put it this way: a friend of mine found his copy. I didn't have a copy of it. A friend of mine found like a copy of it the other day.
Yeah,
like a couple of years ago. And gave it to me, and I sort of flicked through it and nearly like self combusted with embarrassment. So hopefully no one will ever find this motherfucking thing. But now I'm talking about it in a public forum, so I'm the idiot.
Oh man, it's so like. So I'm 32, and so like all my teenage bullshit, and like you two, there's no like, there's only artifacts. Like you might be able to find something. But now,
yeah, sure.
Like, kids going through it now, it's like everything is public record, like forever.
Totally, totally. We're off topic, but who cares? Like, speaking to a couple of friends of mine who are teachers, and whether at high school or at university level or whatever,
yeah.
a lot of kids coming up now avoid social media like the plague, or at least Ooh. Our version of it. A friend of mine teaches art at a college, mm-hmm. and she told one of her students that she was great and that she should put some stuff on Instagram. And the student was like, "Are you fucking joking? I don't have an Instagram account. Why would I have an Instagram account? Nobody has Instagram accounts." And in her particular social milieu,
yeah.
and it's kind of interesting that I think that the whole thing, not just of kind of social media obsession, but of being completely awful on social media, which 99% of it is these days,
yeah.
seems to be a pretty kind of, for want of a less loaded term, like millennial preoccupation. And
Ooh,
I think
yeah.
that people who are kind of a generation younger than you and I, savvy to the fact that it kind of made all of us into pricks. and I'm very glad about that. I think that's a really yeah. good thing. But I know exactly what you mean. I mean, Christ, there's a lot of people whose every kind of like idiotic utterance. I mean, Christ, there's enough idiotic utterances of mine floating around on the internet to keep anybody who's so minded busy for some time anyway.
Yeah.
And I guess the one thing that I would say about that is that hopefully I like to think it's taught me a little bit of humility and a little bit of like, it taught me to pause a little bit before rushing to judgment of other people.
Oh yeah.
I like to think.
Yeah.
I mean, whether or not that's true, who knows?
Hey man, you're human.
Yeah, that's the rumor.
Frank, you're being hard on my friend. Frank. It's going back to, I guess we can go back to music. but yeah,
now that we've settled that whole issue.
But you, yeah, put that to bed. But you talking about, it's interesting to me, you talking about just even though like England and the US are similar in a lot of ways, like the pop culture differences are so crazy. Like,
yeah.
Like, I remember flying to London a couple years ago, and there's, like, a Pet Shop Boys, like, live show on, like, the, you know, the video in the headrest you can watch. And I was like,
yeah, yeah.
Pet Shop Boys? Like, what they do?
But they're incredible. They're yeah. huge. I mean, they're absolutely huge. And an amazing band. Sorry, give me one second. I just need to send a text message
you're
very
fine.
Quickly. Sorry, somebody's on the phone
it's
trying
okay.
to call me.
No, you're good.
Need to tell him that I got
no worries.
Sorry about that.
Nah,
so the Pet Shop Boys is actually an incredible band. Like, I mean,
right.
they're a self-consciously kind of like pop band, but they also like they were laced with an intelligence. I'm going to get the exact quote wrong, but there's a line on their first record which is like, "You wanted to find true love, I just wanted to find a job," which
yeah.
I think is a pretty vicious
right.
opening line for a song.
Yeah.
But anyway, there are pop cultural differences. I mean, I think the main thing to stress is that I'm in America. In the UK, American culture predominates to a surprising degree because we all watch Hollywood movies and we all watch American TV shows.
Yeah.
And like put it this way, I knew what a prom was growing up.
Yeah.
There are no proms in the UK. It's not a thing.
Yeah.
Or at least I think some places have them now because of what we're talking about here. But like nobody had a prom when I was a kid, but everybody knows what a prom is.
Yeah.
Because we all watched any American high school teen movie or whatever. And there's something quite strange about coming to the States for the first time. I mean, obviously I've been to America a lot now in my life. Right. I'm very fortunate in that. But like the first couple of times you come, it's quite weird because it's like you're stepping into TV or something. but kind of in a cool way.
Yeah.
The other thing as well that has really informed my career as a musician is that a thing I distinctly remember from when I was playing and hanging out on that hardcore scene I was talking about earlier was that, you know, we had bands. There were some great bands. There was Knuckle Dust, Stamping Ground, Special Move, Nine Bar, all these kind of bands who were really good. I loved them all.
Yeah.
But American bands would come through, whether it would be like Walls of Jericho or Integrity or like, Indecision, those kinds of bands would come through and play, our little hardcore venues, and they would wipe the fucking floor with our bands. They would be 100,000 times better.
Yeah.
And even as like a 17-year-old, I remember trying to analyze why this was the case, and I figured it out pretty quickly, which is that you can tour more in America than you can in the UK. The UK is a small country,
right.
And particularly when, as I was saying, the hardcore scene is so limited in terms of number of people, there was a circuit you could do. It was like 5 shows.
Mm-hmm.
And once you'd done those 5 shows, you played to everybody on the scene kind of thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? And whereas, you know, so a UK hardcore band could do maybe 50 shows a year at a push. Before you're boring the shit out of everybody. Whereas, you know, a band like Indecision would come through and they were doing 300 shows a year because they were touring all around the States and all around Canada and then also coming to the UK.
Yeah.
And that combined with the fact that my Bible when I was a kid was Get in the Van, Henry Rollins.
Great book.
Diaries. Yeah. Yeah, which I literally used to read it like it was like religious scripture. And it really, it gave me this desire really early on to be somebody who toured a lot, you know, and
that,
as far as I was concerned, that's what you had to do to be good.
Right.
And it is true to a degree. I mean, if you do what I do every day for a certain amount of time, either you get better at it or hopefully it dawns on you that it's not for you.
Yeah.
One or the other. But like, you know, and you get to the point of doing that many shows and it really hones you as an artist, you know, and so right from the beginning of my career, I've toured as much as humanly possible, and I think it's kind of defined my music and my career and my art to a large degree is that I was somebody who tours a lot.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting talking to like English bands that come over and they're talking about like drive times, like to the next show, and they're like, if they're talking about like touring in England, they're like, man, that's like, buddy, that's like 2 hours away. They're just like,
yeah.
All right, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, right,
exactly. Whereas by contrast, I remember one of the first tours we did over here in the States, we played in Salt Lake City, opening for Social D.
Yeah.
And I was selling my own merch on the tour, and this couple came up to the merch table and said, hey, we just got here. We drove 8 hours for the show. We're looking forward to your set. And I'd already played, and I was just like, hold on, first of all, you drove eight fucking hours to be here? Like, from where? And they were from, like, Montana or something, I don't know, like, far away.
Right.
And this was the nearest show to them on the tour.
Yeah.
And then secondly, I was like, you missed my show, so I just got my guitar and went and played him a show in the parking lot, because it was like, there's no way I'm letting you guys drive that far and not see something. Do you know what I mean? That's ridiculous. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you get used to it. Like the first full band tour I did in the States in 2010, my guys came over and we opened for Flogging Molly for a tour.
Yeah.
And we were in an Econoline van with a trailer and they were in a bus, and boy, there's a difference there. And so we were driving and we had one crew member who was our tour manager, sound guy, Casey, and then I was doing merch and we were teching ourselves.
Right.
And, that tour was like 3 months, and it was this absolute baptism of fire.
Right.
Because we were driving 8 hours driving every day. staying in like two, six people staying in two rooms in a motel, and living off, like, we had no money. We weren't getting paid much for the shows, and it was just the hardest work. And it was like, when we got to the end of the tour as a collective unit, both personally and musically, it was like, okay, we made it. We're now different. Like, we came back to the England and people were like, holy shit, you guys are better at what you do.
Yeah.
Because we kind of survived this baptism of fire.
Yeah.
You know, of working that hard. I mean, it was great. It was really fun, and it's a very special memory for me, but like, boy was it rough from time to time.
Yeah, there's a fun story that I think Lars Fredriksson tells about them going on tour with the Ramones in like 96, and how Rancid had a tour bus and the Ramones were, you know, they're like known for just having a van, the same van. And I guess Joey Ramone shit on Rancid's tour bus, like knowing what like knowing what was going to happen. But Rancid was just like, yeah, you can use the bathroom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fucking Joey Ramone. What are you going to do?
Right. Yeah. Another thing, talking about Rancid, you and Billy Bragg have done stuff together.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Sorry, were you about to say something?
No.
Oh, yeah. The first time I heard Billy Bragg, it was because Lars Fredriksson did that cover of The Haves and Have Nots. And I was like, I didn't know that was a cover.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Billy's amazing. He's been a hugely supportive guy. Mm-hmm. Not just for me, but like, one of the things I really respect about him is that at his age, and I don't mean to make him sound like a granddad, but like at his age, I think, put it this way, I read an interview once with Loudon Wainwright III, who's one of my favorite songwriters, and the interviewer asked him about a couple of like new bands, and he was like, I'm fucking 70, I don't care.
Yeah.
And that's kind of legit, actually. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Whereas by contrast, like, Bill is so up on what's happening. And like, he helped me out early doors, and he's always helping out younger, newer acts who are coming up and giving them supports and giving them slots on festival stages or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And I really, really respect that. You know, there's a kind of hunger and a dedication there, which I think is really cool. And he's just a lovely guy and a great writer as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I think that, well, I mean, to get into the weeds on this just for a second, one of the things about Billy for me, which I found quite instructive as a writer, is that, like, you know, there are occasionally political songs in my canon, but I've very early on stopped putting kind of stress on that because I saw Billy's career, and Billy is an intelligent and self-conscious man who's done this on purpose, and it's not like a criticism of him per se, but because he puts politics at the forefront of what he does, people evaluate him as a politician before they do it as a songwriter.
Yeah.
And personally, I think that's a shame because I think he's a phenomenal songwriter.
Right.
And I think that for me, some of his songs, my favorite song of his is Levi Stubbs' Tears.
Oh,
which
so
is
good.
Sort of, it's like semi-political, but like even stuff like Tank Park Salute and Brickbat and songs like that, though, that's his kind of peak for me as a writer. And people generally tend to not pay that much attention to those songs because politics is at the forefront of what he does.
Yeah.
And for myself, like, you know, I mean, it's funny I should say this while I'm sitting in a dressing room on a Counting Crows tour, because like, I've always wanted to be Adam Duritz a lot more than I ever wanted to be Billy Bragg. And I say that with all the love in the world for Billy Bragg, but it's like, I'd love to be considered as a songwriter first and foremost, you know? And that's much more important to me than politics.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to think that I'm an aware, an informed citizen.
For sure.
And you know, there are moments when that comes into my music, and that's fine, and that's my right, and it's the thing I enjoy doing from time to time. But first and foremost, I want to be known as and considered as a songwriter.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... I get, and like you were saying, not bashing Billy Bragg or anything, but that is a shame that, like, he gets thought of like, the political song guy first.
Well, but this is it, you know, and, like, if you go to a Billy Bragg show, particularly, I mean, I don't know how it is in the States, but in the UK, it's kind of like a Labour Party conference.
Right.
And not only that, but like, you know, the kind of the internecine feuding of the left, which is endemic in the UK, as I'm sure it is in the US, yeah, like kind of can quite often overshadow the music that's being played,
yeah,
you know, and like, For example, I mean, I did this Q&A thing with Billy one time before a show we did. It was like a benefit show. And some guy, you know, wearing like a Billy Bragg t-shirt got up and was just like hounding Billy for the fact that there was this one election in 2010 where Billy suggested voting tactically for a different party to get the Tories out in a particular constituency, which happened incidentally to have been the intelligent thing to do because the Labour Party were never going to win in that constituency. But for certain people, not voting for the Labour Party is just like, is
not gonna
apostasy.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Yep. And this guy, and this was a good 6 years after this election had taken place, and this guy's on his feet being like, you betrayed the Labour Party, blah 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 blah. And I remember, and Billy handled it well, you know, and he argued his case and everything, and I remember sitting next to him being like, man, if that guy was saying that to me, I'd just tell him to go fuck himself. Do you know what I mean? Like, and you know, it was, but also the whole conversation was about politics. As I say, that's a choice that Billy has made consciously, and that's what he wants to do, and that's totally legit. But I sat there on that day thinking to myself, man, I'm glad that that's not how my life goes, because I'm just not interested enough for it to be the central focus of every conversation that I have.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, the, Yeah, I can't think of, I'm trying to equate like an American guy. I don't know, maybe, I was going to say Bruce Springsteen gets political, but not like that.
Well, that's the thing. I think that Bruce Springsteen treads the line very well.
Yeah.
And like a bazillion other people, he's somebody I find very inspirational. But the contrast would be with someone like Phil Ochs, do you know what I mean? Who, Phil Ochs was a phenomenal songwriter, but not only was he hyper-political, but he was so specific in his song subjects and song matter and all the rest of it that from the vantage point of 2021, you kind of need a history degree to know what the fuck he's talking about.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And that's a shame to me because he was a brilliant writer.
Yeah. Isn't there a Billy Bragg song like The Ghost of Phil Ochs or something?
I think so. Yeah. But he was great. He was phenomenal. He was amazing.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. But Levi Stubbs, can't beat it.
Yeah, so I mean, I had the great fortune of duetting on that song with Bill at Glastonbury one year.
Were you playing the trumpet part?
thankfully, no. No, I was just kind of. I was a little bit like a spare wheel. I was just sort of doubling up the guitar part and singing a harmony here and there. But it was very lovely of him to let me join in.
Yeah. Oh man. Ooh, and another one. Well, this will be my last. This is my favorite Billy Bragg song, but he does that. That like spoken word bit over Walk Away, Renee.
Oh yeah, this is phenomenal. Just at the end of it,
crazy.
One day it happened.
Yeah.
You cut your hair differently, and I stopped loving you.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just and God damn it, is that one of the truest lines ever spoken?
Yeah, and he's got another line. It's like until the bath water grew cold around me, something like that. I was like, damn it, so good.
Yeah, yeah, very good.
Oh man, Mongol Horde. That's your hardcore jazz band.
Yeah, hardcore, noise rock, whatever you want to call it. I mean, who cares, right? It's a lot of fun. It's me. It's Ben, who is the guy I grew up with playing. And he was that whole journey through hardcore and everything I was talking about earlier. He was like the one other guy who was interested.
Mm-hmm.
So we formed this band, Knee Jerk, when we were like 16 together. And then we were in Million Dead together. And a big part of the reason for forming Mongol Horde was that I wanted to hang out with Ben more, basically.
Yeah.
And we've been in bands together for so long that I'd never got into the habit of just calling him to hang out. Mm. So when Million Dead broke up, I then didn't see him for like 3 years. And it was like, where's Ben? Like, what the fuck is going on? So we formed a new band just so that we could hang out. But it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's not like a joke band, but it's definitely not a particularly serious band.
Yeah.
It's our central rule for us as a band is that it has to be a laugh.
Yeah. Yeah, what's the? I saw the. I watched some videos. Blistering blue barnacles.
Yes. Yeah, which is a phrase from a Tintin book.
Yeah.
Do you have Tintin over there?
I've heard of Tintin. It's
like it was a Belgian children's book, and I read it a lot when I was a kid. And there's a character called Captain Haddock who shouts "blistering blue barnacles" at people all the time. So, hence the song title. But it's a song about being a pirate.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some like I noticed there is some like nautical themes in some of your writing.
Mm.
Is that a conscious thing or?
No, not really. It just kind of it's been pointed out that I talk about the sea and rivers and water a lot in my writing. I mean, I guess it's an obsession of mine on some level. And in fact, I have finally put my money where my mouth is, and I just moved to an island.
Yeah.
So I did. I mean, within the United Kingdom, but I now live on a beach, basically. And I get to. Yeah, it's fucking sensational to wake up in the morning and be able to see the sea. You know, and it does excellent things for my mental health, actually. I find the sea extremely calming.
Ooh, yeah.
And you know, I have some reasonably severe issues with anxiety and stuff like that, so it's to be able to look at the sea is something that does good things for that. My wife pointed this out some time ago. It's one of those things. I mean, we moved during the pandemic times, and it was one of those things. I think, like a lot of people, the maybe one day became, well, why not today? Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Why are we, particularly given that London died in its ass, and I lived in London for 20 years, and it could just kind of ceased to be London. It was like, well, why are we still paying this kind of money to live here? So we moved to an island, and it's sensational. I can't recommend it highly enough.
That's cool. Yeah. Sea can be tranquil, can also be angry.
It certainly can. My main thing, when I look at the sea, I just think to myself that all of the things that are pissing me off in the world that could be pushed into the sea.
Ooh.
And would then sink without a trace.
Yeah.
And then the sea would still be there. And there's just that kind of mental thought process I find quite useful. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like, eh.
Yeah. I like, recently I got into watching like seafloor documentaries of like animal, like fish living down there that like don't see light.
And oh yeah, like, right.
It's just such, there's so much like, I can see why like sailors thought there were monsters, like literal monsters in the sea.
Oh yeah, totally. Well, there's that whole business that we know more about like the surface of the moon than we do about the deepest parts of the sea.
Yeah.
Which is kind of insane. And there's much more for us to learn, I'm sure.
Yeah. Do you boat now that you're?
I don't. A lot of people say that a boat is a hole in the sea that you pour money into.
Ooh, that's true.
But the thing that we've realized is quite a lot of our neighbors have boats, and they all feel real guilty about the amount of money they've spent on a boat, and they're desperate for other people to borrow them. So it's just like, sweet, I'll borrow your boat. That's no problem.
Man.
So that works. But it's also the greatest hangover cure known to man is to just walk into the sea.
Ooh.
You wake up in the morning feeling like shit, just go and get in the sea, you'll feel better.
Yeah. Do you have a captain's hat, or have you bought more like Tommy Bahama type shirts or anything?
I mean, I had some Tommy Bahama shirts already. I have a captain's hat actually that I was given by Jammin' from Larry and His Flask. If you know that band from the phenomenal punk band from Oregon.
Okay.
And he always used to wear this captain's hat on stage, and that band is sadly no longer a going concern, and he gave me his captain's hat, and I wear it on occasion, should we say.
Yeah.
Not every day.
Right. It's just you're walking around. It's not your walking around hat. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's special occasions.
Yeah. I also... Maybe I'm projecting, but there's like some religious themes in some of your lyrics.
I would say there's religious imagery.
I mean,
for whatever it's worth, I'm an atheist, but you know, not particularly militantly so.
I
couldn't really give a fuck what anybody else chooses to believe, as long as they're not trying to proselytize in my direction.
Yeah.
Have at it. My grandfather was a priest. My mother is very religious. I also believe pretty firmly that, like, to be able to interpret Western culture of the last 1,000 years, you need to have a working knowledge of the Bible. And indeed, that applies to other cultures as well. I think that at least a passing knowledge of, like, the workings of Islam is important for understanding the beauties of Muslim culture. And not that I have anything beyond a passing knowledge of Islam, but like, and similarly, you know, Buddhism, whatever else, like, you know, religion has played such a huge role in human history that you have to kind of like engage with it to some degree to be able to parse and interpret people's, not just sort of thoughts and behavior and actions and writing, but art as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, all of that's a very fancy sentence or two right there. I do think that, like, yeah, religious imagery creeps into what I do, but it's more just because I think that in the 16th and 17th century, if you were a great writer, you were probably going to express that in a religious context. Mm. You know what I mean? The language of the King James Version of the Bible is John Wycliffe is phenomenal and beautiful and is used by everybody from Dylan on down. So so I'm just sticking with that gang.
Yeah. Are you reading anything now? Are you a big reader?
I'm a very big reader. Yeah, yeah, I read a lot. I'm currently reading A History of the Early 1970s.
Oh, are you a big history guy?
Yeah, I studied history when I went to college, and I studied Central and East European history, but I'm pretty kind of omnivorous in my history tastes. With a special nod towards music history, I'm very interested in the history of my profession, you know? And that extends to reading books about like artists that I'm not necessarily a huge fan of their music, but it's just interesting to know about their career, do you know what I mean, and about how that went down or whatever.
Yeah.
But I am actually a fan of this person. But like next on my reading list is a new biography of Nico, which a friend of mine wrote and sent in my direction. So, but yeah, you know, I find history fascinating.
Nico, like Velvet Underground, Nico.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Cool. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Mm. Is there another person that maybe you weren't like a
I read Rod Stewart's autobiography. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can't say I'm a huge fan of his work, but it was interesting to read. Yeah. You know, and I read the Phil Collins book, and I read. I recently read a biography of Guns N' Roses, which is a band that I really, really, really dislike. But you know, I remember all of that kind of happening when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to read more about what actually went down behind the scenes and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of still think they're assholes, but it was interesting to have the details and the ways in which that they were assholes in the late 80s and early 90s.
Yeah. VH1's Behind the Music played a big role in my childhood. And there's a Metallica episode and they talk about the incident in St. Louis, I can't remember where, but Guns N' Roses canceled like 30 minutes before their set, and the crowd just like tore the arena apart.
Yeah. I'm a big old Metallica fan as well. So, yeah.
Have you seen them live?
I've seen them live once, yeah. And, yeah. But in fact, it was the time when Joey Jordison and Dave Lombardo filled in on drums because Lars wasn't well.
It was a
festival in the UK. And I happened to be there, and it was sensational. That said, I mean, I'm not sure quite how on the whole Lars bashing bandwagon I am in general. Anyway, I think he's a limited drummer, but he's also been the driving force of probably the biggest metal band in history, and that's kind of inarguable.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. He's got a weird. I love his accent. It's just enough of an accent to where it's like, you know, he sounds a little silly but not crazy.
Totally. I know people who have encountered him as in, like he's very much like Billy Bragg. He's very kind of dialed into kind of newer bands and younger bands and that kind of thing. And I know people who've kind of encountered him in that context who have nothing but good things to say about the guy. So
I saw they'll play a bunch on like Howard Stern. And I saw recently they played with Miley Cyrus on Howard Stern.
Huh.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Are there any newer like hardcore bands, younger hardcore bands that you're into right now?
Yeah. I should preface this by sort of stating that I'm like completely not like dialed into the scene.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I got that new Turnstile record.
Ooh,
which I think
so
is,
good.
Yeah, very, very, very good hardcore record. I'm not sure whether they qualify as a hardcore band, but I'm a big fan of The Armed. I think they're sensational. And then, like, I mean, I'm pretty long-term obsessed with Converge,
right.
and Every Time I Die, neither of which are kind of new hardcore bands, but they're also, they are still going concerns as bands, and I'm a big fan of their work. So I tend to try and keep up with what those guys are doing. I go through my phases. I mean, recently I've been listening to a lot of death metal and black metal, which is a genre that I have a kind of a toe dipped in that water.
Yeah.
I've been listening to Necrophagist quite a lot lately, which is completely insane. In a way that I really enjoy. Actually, the other one that's worth a mention, and I would hesitate to try and genre specify this artist, but have you come across Lingua Ignota?
Mm-mm.
Oh boy, set aside an hour of your time and listen to Lingua Ignota, because she will rearrange your thinking about music as a concept.
Okay.
I mean, and it's like, it's sort of, it's choral and it's classical, but it's also kind of death metal, and it's also kind of noise, and there's a bit of Godspeed kind of vibes thrown mm-hmm. in there. And as far as I can tell, it's one person doing all of it, but I'm not 100% sure about that because information is pretty limited that I can find. But yeah, Lingua Ignota is like mind-bending.
Have you ever... So you kind of like... Your musical projects, they kind of, they're not all over the place, but they explore different things. Like,
yeah.
Is there a genre that you've thought about doing a project for that you haven't done yet?
Well, there is a project that I've been working on for nearly a decade now with a friend of mine. And it's mainly because we're both busy doing other shit.
Right.
But this guy is my oldest friend. I've known him since I was 3 years old. And we formed our first band together when we were 10, playing AC/DC and Nirvana covers. And he is deep in the world of, like, demented, fucked up electronic music, like kind of Warp Records, Aphex Twin, that sort of shit.
Okay.
And we've been working on a thing together for a long time. All being well, it will finally come out next year. But in fairness, I have been saying that for some time. So,
yeah.
it's really, really seriously fucked up, and I'm excited for people to hear that.
Fucked up in a fun way.
Oh yeah, totally, totally. But like, it's deliberately uncomfortable.
Okay.
Let's put it that way.
I gotcha.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's not easy listening.
Yeah.
I'll say this: my wife hates it. When we've been working on mixes, I have to do it on headphones.
Oh Jesus, that I love it. I'm excited for it. This might be your I know you say you don't like Guns N' Roses, but this is like your Chinese Democracy. Like it's coming out, man. I swear it's coming out.
Oh boy, I hope it's better than Chinese
Democracy. Oh, I'm sure it will be. Oh man, okay. Do you want to do a bit? I came up with a little bit.
Okay.
I'm a bits guy. Love bits.
Okay. Let's do a bit.
It's nothing crazy. You know, we're just, you know. I'm going to pitch you some collaborations.
Mm-hmm.
And we can just work through what might be the best for you.
Okay.
The first group, the power duo I came up with, Can I Be Frank? And it's a Frank Ocean collab. you and Frank Ocean.
I'm not super familiar with Frank Ocean's music,
mm-hmm.
but I'm going to talk about this carefully. I've encountered him professionally,
okay.
Should we say, and did not have a good experience.
I'm sure he's tough to get along with. He seems like a very artsy, like don't talk to me type of dude. Maybe
a friend of mine was on his crew, and she is no longer on his crew.
Okay.
And I think that I should probably leave that there.
Okay, that's fine. But, I had a secondary Frank that in case something like this happened. Okay, it's still going to be Can I Be Frank, but it's with the Frank Stallone.
I don't know who Frank Stallone is.
Sylvester Stallone's brother.
that I'm sold on.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't imagine that wouldn't be sensational.
Frank Stallone, he's got like a music career. It's just, you know,
really,
that's
I did not know that. Is it any good?
It's not good. It's, it's like what's his name, who's the bad karate guy, what's his name, what the fuck,
from Karate Kid?
No. I can't even think. Everybody makes fun of him now. He goes to Russia and does demonstrations.
Oh, Steven Seagal.
Steven Seagal. You know, Steven Seagal does music.
The bad karate guy.
Yeah. I couldn't think of Steven Seagal. But, you know, Steven Seagal's got records out there.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. So next one is, it's not a music. This is more of like a movie, maybe short series type of deal. This is called Frank and Beans, where Frank Turner and Mr. Bean like buddy cop movie.
Yeah, fuck it, I'm in. I mean, I love Rowan Atkinson a lot. Right. I mean, I'd hesitate to say that Mr. Bean was my favorite thing that he's done, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I respect it. But yeah, sure, I'm in. Sign me up.
What like? So he's more of like an English in that bubble. So like, what's some other stuff he did?
He was wildly famous in England before he did Mr. Bean.
Really?
Probably the biggest thing he did was a thing called Blackadder, which is a sort of historical comedy.
Okay.
And it's absolutely incredible, and I heartily recommend. Like, everybody, certainly everybody my age in England, like, our entire kind of library of quotes, if you know what I mean,
yeah.
comic quotes, pretty much all comes from Blackadder. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And that was his kind of vehicle. So, yeah, he did a bunch of stuff for that. His early stand-up from like the 80s is worth checking out as well. He was a very funny man.
I'll check it out. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we get like, you know, every once in a while there'll be like a BBC show on Netflix or something over here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just get like bits and pieces of, like, I remember when first hearing about like the Mighty Boosh, I had to like download episodes, like torrent episodes.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Boosh is amazing.
It's
Boosh
great.
Is fucking great. Yeah.
Okay. Third one is a cover band, the Frank Turner Overdrive, a Bachman Turner Overdrive.
I'm sold. Great band. I actually did a live stream in March this year with my friend Emily Barker, who's an Australian folk singer who lives in the UK, and we called it Barker Turner Overdrive.
Oh shit.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm possibly a step ahead of you there.
Damn it. Oh, I didn't do enough research. Damn it. Okay. Those are the three that I came up with this morning.
Okay. I mean, I'm sold on, let's do all of them, fuck it.
Okay. I'm gonna put you down for all of them.
Okay, cool.
I'll write something up formally and send it over to you. Well, yeah, we've done like 50 minutes, man. I appreciate your time. Do you have any closing things to say? Or?
Yeah, I mean, just it's been a pleasure, and I'm excited to be in the States now, and we're going to be back here again next year with the new record to be out in February, and then we'll be hitting the road hard. And it's a record that's designed to be played in like packed, sweaty rooms.
Hell yeah.
I'm looking forward to bringing that over here.
Hell yeah.
Next year.
Cool. Well, stay on for a second, but Frank, you had options, but you decided to talk to me. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.